Welcome. In the previous lecture, we looked at the blending of Greek and Roman religion down to the Principate and beyond. Religion is just one aspect, albeit an extremely important one, of that peculiar and distinctive amalgam that we call Greco-Roman. I'll have a lot more to say about other aspects of that amalgam in later lectures, but before I do so, I want to talk about the physical setting in which the Romans encountered the Greeks. That setting was predominantly an urban one, and it was in an urban setting too that the blending of the two cultures primarily took place, and indeed where, through competitiveness as well, ruler cult was an institution that enabled cities to compete against another. It's estimated that in classical Greece, only a small percentage of the population were city dwellers. The percentage in the Roman Empire would have been considerably higher, though certainly the majority still lived in the countryside. That said, we shouldn't assume a hard and fast divide between urban dweller and country dweller. Many who lived in proximity to a city would have been dependent upon it both economically and as a refuge in time of war. As far as the Greeks were concerned, the polis, the city-state, autonomous, self-sufficient, independent, was the highest civilizing force on the face of the earth. But the Romans did not buy into that idealistic view. They tended to think of the polis as a place that fostered sedition. Even so, the Greek polis continued to flourish as a social and civic entity under Roman rule. Indeed, several new polis sprang up under Roman rule in the Black Sea region and in Anatolia, both in northern Turkey, for instance. There were, however, profound differences between the classical Greek city-state and its manifestation under Roman rule. First, and most obviously, interstate warfare was banned. No Greek community could make war against any other. Second, democracy in its classical form was no longer tolerated. Instead, pro-Roman aristocracies effectively exercised power, liaising closely with the Roman governor or his representative. And third, there was a diminution in the varieties of cultural difference that previously helped to define the various polis. Instead of the deep divide between Spartan and Athenian culture, for instance, a less locally distinctive, less individualistic Greek culture emerged that made one polis very much like any other. We saw in a previous lecture how a uniform dialect, koine, became widespread throughout the Hellenistic world. And this is just one example of the diminution in difference that I'm talking of. Even so, Greeks still tended to identify themselves as citizens of a particular polis, first and foremost, and there remained a considerable degree of local pride. The Greek word for this is philotimia, literally love of honour, and though it is usually applied to individuals, it also helps to explain the continuing rivalries between communities that were expressed in the form of lavish public works, festivals, honours showered on visiting dignitaries, including emperors, and so on. It's a fact that 6 out of the 9 most populous cities in the Roman world were Greek-speaking. And this, incidentally, is why scholars believe that there was more Greek spoken throughout the empire than Latin, certainly by the imperial period onwards. The 6 include Alexandria in Egypt, Antioch, Apamea, Ephesus and Pergamum, and Corinth in mainland Greece. All had populations ranging from 200,000 upwards, all were situated on or near the Mediterranean coast, and all derived their importance largely from trade. The other 3 were Rome, Carthage in Tunisia, and Lugdunum, modern Lyon, in France. The biggest city of all was Rome, which already by the middle of the 2nd century BC had become the most populous city by far in Italy. 200 years later, Rome's population had already reached perhaps as many as 1 million inhabitants. We should also note that 5 out of the 6 Greek-speaking cities were Hellenistic foundations. There was, in fact, a marked difference in the relative prosperity of the cities of mainland Greece under Roman rule and that of the Hellenistic Greek cities in the east. For the most part, cities in mainland Greece did not initially prosper under Roman rule, though they did experience something of a revival from the second half of the first century AD. In fact, many of them were experiencing a decline already in the early part of the Hellenistic era. And that's particularly true of Athens, whose democracy, by the end of the 4th century BC, had already become little more than a catchphrase, devoid of any real meaning, largely because the city now lived in the shadow of Macedon. As a result, it became depressingly sycophantic, largely because it no longer had the power to enact an independent foreign policy. As evidence of this, I'd cite a hymn that was written in honour of Demetrius Polyorkites, Demetrius the besieger, in 294 BC. It runs, "The other gods are either far away or don't exist, but you're present. You're not made of wood or stone. You're real." In the later Hellenistic period, Athens consistently backed the loser against Rome, although she was always able to trade on her cultural heritage enough to survive. Athens's fortunes, economic and political, revived considerably in the imperial period, however, as I've just mentioned, so much so that the city deserves a lecture to itself, which I will give it towards the end of our course. So, what I want to do here is to take you on a tour of some of the most flourishing Greek cities under Roman rule, the ones I just mentioned a moment ago. We'll discover that Hellenism in all its manifestations was flourishing well into the period that we call late antiquity, that's to say into the 3rd and 4th centuries AD and beyond. First then, we'll travel to Alexandria. It's the Greek city that we know most about under Roman rule because it's left us a wealth of documentary and other evidence. And it became the largest Greek-speaking city anywhere in the Mediterranean, with the possible exception of Rome, as I mentioned before. Alexandria was founded by Alexander the Great in 331 BC when he liberated, quote-unquote, Egypt from Persian rule. It was a magnificent choice of location. It faces onto the Mediterranean. It possesses excellent natural harbours. It's situated on the western edge of the Nile Delta, and it therefore has access to the interior of Egypt. Alexandria in Egypt was, however, just one of many foundations by Alexander. Plutarch says he founded 80 cities, though that's almost certainly an exaggeration. Alexandria in Egypt was, however, without doubt, by far the greatest. As we've seen, when Alexander died in 323 BC, his general Ptolemy founded a new dynasty and called himself Ptolemy I, Soter, Saviour, King of Egypt. Ptolemy, like other dynasts, was a world-class opportunist. He actually abducted Alexander's body when it was being escorted to Macedon, and then built a spectacular tomb in Egypt in which to display it. He then presented himself to the Greek world as the guardian of the corpse of Alexander, and the glory that accrued to him as a result rubbed off on the city itself. It was Ptolemy I and his son Ptolemy II who made Alexandria the jewel of the Mediterranean. Specifically, they laid the city out on a grid plan. Its lighthouse, known as the Pharos, which was the tallest such structure ever built, 328 feet high, in fact, with at the top of it a fire kept perpetually blazing that could be seen, we're told, 30 miles out to sea. Its purpose was to guide ships to the port rather than to warn them of danger, but it also served as a symbol of Alexandria's cultural prestige. Recent underwater excavations have brought to light its foundations. And secondly, its museum, Museion, to give it its Greek name, or College of the Muses, which allegedly contained a library of some 700,000 rolls. The scholars who worked in the library were charged with the cataloguing, copying, and preservation of pretty much the whole of Greek literature. Unfortunately, no archaeological evidence for the library has come down, and we're not even sure what it looked like. It's conceivable that it consisted mainly of storage rooms. At some point in antiquity, we don't exactly know when and we don't exactly know how, it was burnt down. But by this point, there were other libraries of note in the ancient world, notably one at Pergamum. I'll be talking about Pergamum in a moment. Julius Caesar was so impressed by the library, we're told, that he wanted to build one just like it in Rome, though he was assassinated before he could realize his dream. Incidentally, it's Julius Caesar who usually gets a rap for burning the library down, albeit inadvertently, though the evidence for the claim is highly dubious. Undoubtedly, the most prolific Alexandrian scholar was Didymus, 65 BC to 10 AD, who is said to have written, wait for it, some 3,500 books. He was nicknamed Calcenteros, meaning with bowels of bronze, evidently because he took so few bathroom breaks. Alexandrian scholarship declined around the time of the Roman conquest, around the time of Didymus, therefore, though the city remained important as a centre for medicine and science. Like any other Greek city, Alexandria had its own laws, its own magistrates, and presumably its own council and popular assembly, though we don't hear much about the last two. Though it remained predominantly a Greek city, Alexandria also had a large population of Egyptians and Jews. And in a later lecture, we'll be examining how relations between the Greeks and Jews in that city became so bad that a massacre of Jews took place, one of the first such occurrences in history. Alexandria continued to prosper under Roman rule due to its important location for trade. It was the port from which huge cargo vessels laden with grain would set out from Egypt to feed the population of Rome. And in late antiquity, it remained a centre of learning, particularly of the Neoplatonist school of philosophy. It was also the birthplace of the great geographer and astronomer Ptolemy, whom we'll talk about in a lecture on science. And it was also home to an important Christian community. It was still important in Byzantine times and remained so until the Arab conquest in the 7th century AD. From Egypt, we move northeast along the coast, which in Roman times was the province of Syria. Here, on the banks of the Orontes River, was the great city of Antioch, modern Antakya. Though Antioch was 15 miles from the coast, it was connected to the harbour town of Seleucia by a good road. The city was established in 300 BC by Seleucus I Nicator, Seleucus the Conqueror, the founder of the Seleucid dynasty, as one of the capitals of his empire. Antioch was annexed to the Roman Empire by Pompey the Great in 64 BC, and it eventually became the capital of the Roman province of Syria. Like Alexandria, it was a great city for trade, in this case trade between Asia and the Mediterranean. Its population originally comprised Athenian and Macedonian colonists, though in later times it became home to a large Jewish and Christian community. It had magnificent facilities, including colonnaded streets, baths, theatres, and elegant houses. And it's actually in the circus in Antioch, or a movie version thereof, this is a bit of trivia, where the chariot race in William Wyler's 1959 epic Ben-Hur takes place. Thanks largely to the efforts of a Greek-speaking Jew called Barnabas, who came from Cyprus, Antioch became one of the first cities to embrace Christianity. And it was the first city to be visited by Paul in his travels, as we read in Acts. The Antiochene church was one of the most important in Christendom until the city fell to the Arabs in 641. We now move further up the Turkish coast to Ephesus, situated at the mouth of the river Kaister, or Meander. In the Hellenistic period, Ephesus was first ruled by the Seleucids and then by the Attalids of Pergamum before it passed into Roman hands in 133 BC. It subsequently had a rather checkered history with Rome. In 88 BC, Ephesus enthusiastically supported Mithridates VI, when the dynast caused Provincia Asia, the province of Asia, to rise up against Rome. And in consequence, Sulla sacked the city and deprived it of its free status. In the reign of Augustus, however, Ephesus staged an impressive recovery and was made the capital of the province of Asia. It was at this time that it acquired an architectural splendor commensurate with its administrative importance. It had temples to Julius Caesar, Domitian, and Hadrian. And it was one of the cities that Paul visited on his missionary travels in AD 53, though it gave him a somewhat hostile reception, as we learn from Acts 19. The author of Acts tells us that a silversmith named Demetrius, who made his livelihood by selling miniature shrines of the goddess Artemis, objected to the fact that Paul was touting a god that was, I quote, not made with human hands. Couldn't be represented, therefore, with the result that a riot broke out when he addressed the townsfolk in the theatre. Poor old Demetrius saw the bottom dropping out of his lucrative trade if Paul's new god really took off and supplanted Artemis. And no doubt the wealth of the Ephesians in general was partly based on the fame of the Temple of Artemis. Pliny the Elder described it as a wonderful testimony of Greek magnificence. It's actually said to have been the first Greek temple built entirely out of marble. Ephesus was, in fact, one of the wealthiest cities in the ancient world. It possessed no fewer than four huge gymnasia, a magnificent library, extremely lavish private houses, and streets that were literally paved with marble. It even had street lighting. It had, however, an ongoing battle with the river Meander, which continually was silting up its harbour. And today, the ancient city is far from the coast. Ephesus was destroyed by the Goths in AD 262, but it later recovered to become a very important site of pilgrimage. The evangelist St. John is said to have been buried on the hill overlooking the Temple of Artemis. One of Ephesus's most famous sons was Ammianus Marcellinus, the last great historian of Rome, lived in the 4th century AD. His history draws heavily from the Greek model of historiography in that it contains several geographical and ethnographical digressions in the manner of Herodotus, the father of history. Again, we travel north, this time to Pergamum, modern Bergama, about 16 miles from the Turkish coast. We talked about the Attalid dynasty, which ruled it in a previous lecture. You'll recall that the founder of the dynasty, Philotyrus, had been left in charge of a large treasury by Lysimachus, one of Alexander the Great's generals, and that when Lysimachus died, he used the fortune to establish himself as ruler of Pergamum. Pergamum commands an absolutely stunning site. It's built on two levels, on an acropolis and on the plain that surrounds it. It was its fourth king, Eumenes II, ruled 197 to 159 BC, that transformed Pergamum into a magnificent, bustling, Hellenistic metropolis. And it became, in effect, a second Athens. Situated on the acropolis was an agora, a sanctuary of Athena, a royal palace, and a theatre with seating capacity for 10,000. The theatre has the steepest cavea, or auditorium, of all Greek theatres. And the library was second only to the one in Alexandria in size. Pergamum, by the way, was celebrated for its parchment, the writing material that eventually replaced papyrus. But the crowning glory, architecturally speaking, was the Great Altar, without question one of the most spectacular of all Hellenistic structures. We don't know for certain when it was constructed, but it was probably in the reign of Eumenes II. The Great Altar stood in its own precinct. Around the outside of the structure that houses the altar runs a frieze, 110 metres in length, depicting a gigantomachy, a battle between gods and giants. It's actually a battle between civilization, represented by the gods, and barbarism, represented by the giants. And this is an allusive reference to Pergamum's own struggles against the Gauls. So for giants, read Gauls, and for gods, read the good people of Pergamum. And it's all in the grand style. In the words of Mary Beard and John Henderson, the Great Altar is, I quote, an unapologetic exercise in hyperbole, both in terms of its subject matter and in terms of its execution. As we saw earlier, the last king of Pergamum, Attalus III, who died in 133 BC, bequeathed his kingdom to the Romans. And about half a century later, Pergamum lost its favoured status as ally of Rome by siding with Mithridates VI, just as Ephesus had done. The city recovered in the first century AD, however, and became an important Roman administrative centre, albeit subordinate to Ephesus. And it was in this period that the plain surrounding the Acropolis was developed. Pergamum now acquired an amphitheatre with seating capacity of about 50,000 and a second theatre with seating capacity of 30,000. Under the emperors, the sanctuary of Asclepius, which had been built in the 4th century BC, became the foremost Asclepion in the Greek-speaking East. One of Pergamum's most famous citizens was, in fact, the physician Galen, who practiced medicine there, and whom I'll be talking about in a later lecture. In the mid-3rd century AD, however, the city was being repeatedly attacked by the Goths, and it began to contract in size. Finally, we cross the Aegean to mainland Greece, to the northeast Peloponnese, to the city of Corinth on the eastern side of the Corinthian Canal. It was in the sanctuary at Isthmia on the Saronic Gulf, a few miles from Corinth, that Titus Quinctius Flamininus made his famous proclamation of freedom to the Greeks in 196. Half a century later, as we've seen, the city was razed to the ground by Lucius Mummius in reprisals for the fact that it had participated in the revolt against Rome orchestrated by the Achaean League. Virtually all that remained standing after Mummius had done his work was the 6th century BC Temple of Apollo. The site was too important to be left abandoned, however, and in 44 BC, Corinth was refounded by Julius Caesar as part of a more widespread project for reconstructing cities that the Romans had destroyed. His objective was to provide land for his veterans and for manumitted slaves, many of whom were Greek. Corinth was not, however, refounded as a Greek polis, but rather as a Roman colonia or colony. That's to say, it was run on the lines of a Roman city with Roman laws and a Roman governmental system, local magistrates, senate, etc. In the event, Caesar was assassinated before he could carry through on his plan, but the reconstruction was completed under Augustus. Architecturally, Corinth now took on the appearance of a Roman city with an imposing basilica or colonnaded hall aligning the agora. And from 27 BC onwards, it became the administrative and political capital of the Roman province of Achaea. The importance of Corinth's Christian community is indicated by the fact that the city was visited by Paul in the course of his missionary travels. And it was, of course, to the Corinthians, that is to say, to the Greeks living in Corinth, that Paul wrote two of his epistles. They include the famous verse, 1 Corinthians 13, "If I speak in the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I am only a resounding gong or a clanging cymbal." Over the course of time, the Greek population in the city came to outnumber the Roman colonists, as indicated by the fact that under the Emperor Hadrian, Greek became the language that was used in official inscriptions. The city survived well into late antiquity. What I want to turn to next is how Greek cities conducted their affairs under Roman rule. I mentioned earlier that one of the casualties of Roman rule in the Greek-speaking world was democracy. For the most part, the world that the Romans encountered as they extended their control beyond mainland Greece was one where democracy prevailed, albeit in a somewhat truncated or attenuated form. Alexander had sought to export democracy when he freed the cities of Asia Minor from Persian rule, and his successors had followed the same policy. In fact, most, if not all, of the new cities that were established by the Hellenistic kings espoused, in theory at least, some form of democratic principles. That's to say, they had assemblies, councils, and elected magistrates. The fact was, however, that the wealthy increasingly came to wield power, since it was they who now possessed exclusive access to the council and to the magistracies. The assembly, though it continued to rubber stamp decrees, thus became increasingly irrelevant. This then, in summary form, was a situation that the Romans encountered when they took control of the Greek world, and it suited them down to the ground. It meant that they could co-opt the services of the ruling aristocracy and essentially bypass the assembly. Not that they left the Greeks to run their own affairs. On the contrary, they kept a very close eye on the natives, ever alert to the danger of revolutionary activity. One of the best pieces of evidence for what it was like to be a Greek living in the Greek-speaking world under Roman rule around AD 100 comes from a treatise written by Plutarch. Plutarch, philosopher and biographer, became, under the Emperor Hadrian, the imperial procurator to the province of Achaia, in other words, someone very close to the center of the Roman power structure in Greece. And this lends particular authority to a treatise which he wrote entitled Precepts of Statecraft. In it, Plutarch purports to be giving advice to a young Greek aristocrat on how to succeed in politics. Though Greece had been under Roman rule for about 2.5 centuries at the time he wrote it, the same political offices, the same political institutions existed, and likewise the same civic values were promoted. Plutarch repeatedly alludes to the famous men of the past, men like Miltiades, Themistocles, and Pericles, in order to inspire his young friend. Though the reality was, under Roman rule, Greek politicians had very little influence. In fact, Precepts of Statecraft provides an invaluable insight into the kind of toadying behaviour that Greeks had to engage in so as not to fall foul of their Roman masters. Plutarch asks, now when the affairs of city-states no longer involve leadership in wars or the overthrow of tyrannies or making alliances, what opportunities are there for achieving political distinction and fame in the political arena? Well, not a lot is the short answer, but it's still worthwhile doing your bit for the community. One of the most telling pieces of advice that he gives is the following. Arrange your cloak carefully. Keep your eyes on the speaker's platform and don't take pride in the crown that you're wearing by virtue of your office, observing Roman boots above your head. The Greek word that I've translated as Roman boots is kalteos. It's actually Sicilian Greek for calceus, which is Latin for a military boot. So we get the picture of the Roman military scrutinizing very closely what went on in the assembly and other gatherings. It's a pretty chilling picture, particularly since Greece had long been pacified at this point, and it's all the more chilling in light of the fact that Plutarch was himself no doubt drawing from personal experience. The aspiring politician, he goes on to say, should dissemble, be like an actor, so as not to get too worked up and violate what is permitted by, I quote, those who have authority over him, the Romans. Be like an actor. That was precisely one of the complaints that the Romans routinely levelled at the Greeks, as we saw in a previous lecture. A generation or so later, however, a sophist and rhetorician called Aelius Aristides, who studied both in Athens and Pergamum, sang a rather different tune. Aristides was a leading figure in a literary movement known as the Second Sophistic, which placed declamation in the forefront of all the literary genres. In his declamation entitled To Rome, which was written to be delivered in public, Aristides pays tribute to the Romans for having promoted something of a renaissance of Greek culture. And note this, for having given back to Greece her freedom. How often have we heard that claim? He writes, "Now all the Greek cities flourish under you, and the offerings in them, the arts, all their embellishments, bring honour to you. And further, you continually care for the Greeks as if they were your foster fathers, protecting them, resurrecting them, giving freedom and self-rule to the best of them." Note that reference to the Greeks being Rome's foster parents. It's a tactful allusion to the fact that Greek culture was still, well, much more venerable than Roman culture. We've no reason to doubt Aristides' sincerity. Even so, the undeniable tone of obsequiousness reminds us that everything comes with a price. To conclude, though the Greek polis lost much of its original identity under Roman rule, it nonetheless demonstrated an impressive capability to adapt to the loss of political freedom. And if much of what marked each polis as distinctive was swept away, a variety of institutions helped to maintain a certain competitiveness, which was no doubt beneficial to the community at large. The most visible of these were the grandiose architectural projects, which from the Hellenistic period onwards became expressions of local pride. In the next lecture, we're going to turn the magnification up, so to speak, and examine the roles of Romans in Greece and of Greeks in Rome in order to gain some insight into how each of the two peoples functioned in one another's orbit.